Oregon plan is a win-win in bridging the gap between the two Oregons by creating jobs and economic benefits for both rural and urban Oregonians. And some of you may remember that the former representative, Jeff Krupp, and I had a very similar package of bills, and it's great to see you here, former Representative Jeff Krupp, last session, and we came very close to passing that package of bills. However, they got caught up in the sort of end game of the session, and during the interim, that package of bills were reworked, and you'll hear a little bit more about that today, through the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group. We have several members of the Renewable Energy Working Group here today. I was a member of that, along with several other legislators. Representative Burley attended that, Representative Patty Smith, and I also was involved in the Biofuels Subcommittee. So you will, these concepts will be very familiar to you in this package of incentives and renewable fuel standard. But the details have been refined, and we've had the, I should say, luxury of 18 months to really work out many of the details. And also, this plan is important because we're well positioned to become a national leader on both the economic and environmental benefits of alternative fuels. But to secure a competitive advantage for our state in the biofuels market, we have to act this session. And despite how it appears, if any of you listened to the State of the Union address, I did not coordinate this hearing with the White House. I was asked that question this morning by a member of the media. But if any of you did happen to, I really don't have that much clout with the White House, but if any of you happen to read this or listen to the State of the Union address, and I just happen to have a copy here, the President's plan calls for facilitating the growth of renewable and alternative fuel sources by increasing the size and expanding the scope of the current renewable fuel standard. So you will hear some of these themes in the testimony today, I believe. So I just wanted to share that with you. I do believe that without this plan, our economic opportunities will be eclipsed by the states of California and Washington. We're going to hear more from the state of Washington today. We're lucky to have a senator who worked on a similar package that's going to provide testimony today, and I appreciate her coming all the way from Olympia for that, and also other states that are currently taking the lead on this issue. So we want to make sure that we're not left behind. And I hope that when these hearings conclude, we will have a collaborative consensus among members of Oregon's agricultural, manufacturing industries, and our environmental movement, advocates for working families and experts on energy and economic development, which many of you are, that the Renew Oregon Plan is the right step for Oregon. And the time is now to jumpstart the rural economy and to secure Oregon as a leader in this growing industry. And with that, I will ask if my colleague, Representative Phil Barnhart, Representative Barnhart, if you have any other comments you'd like to add before we begin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The Revenue Committee is meeting with the Energy and Environment Committee today precisely so that we can make certain that we understand both the policy issues that are being raised in House Bill 2210 and be prepared to deal with revenue issues that may come up if the bill passes the Energy and Environment Committee and is sent over to the Revenue Committee. We'll be prepared to go forward with that. It is not my intention at this point to hold any additional public hearings on the bill in the Revenue Committee if and when the bill comes to us, but rather to go directly to a work session and to deal with any additional testimony only specifically related to revenue issues at that time. So if you want a shot at the bill, now's your chance.
This is also part of the new and improved and efficient legislature, so we are trying to use your time more wisely as well. So thank you so much, Representative Barnhart. I also, again, want to thank everybody for coming. If you plan to testify, if you haven't already signed up, there's a sign-up sheet. Is it still out there? By the door. So please make sure that you sign up. And if you do, if we don't have time for everybody today, as I mentioned, we will have additional hearings on Friday. And when you do come up to speak, if you have handouts, if you can please give those to the assistant, and they will make sure that everybody up at the dais is receives them, and a reminder that when you do come to testify, please state your name and your address for the record. So we will begin with a brief overview of the bill from Kat, and then we'll call up our first panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Barnhart, committee members. You have before you on the dais a staff measure summary and a copy of HB 2210, the biofuels bill. I'll just summarize that briefly since we're going to have the Department of Energy and others give us a more in-depth overview. HB 2210 creates various tax credits for facilities that produce ethanol, biofuel, and verified fuel additives, for agricultural producers and collectors of biofuel raw materials, and for consumers who purchase biofuel or fuel blends for use in alternative fuel vehicles. The bill also creates a renewable fuel standard and sets standards for certain gasoline additives. You also have in front of you some written testimony that was submitted before the hearing by Al Goljak, who had planned to be here today. He's the president of the Pendleton Grain Growers, and he couldn't attend in person today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, we will start off with our first panel, and now that we've had an overview of the bill, and what I'm planning to do is call you up in a panel. Members, I'm going to ask if the panel can complete their testimony, and then we'll take questions at the end of each panel, unless it's really burning. No pun intended with the fuel here, but we have a lot of people that want to speak, and I want to make sure that they get an opportunity to speak. So we will have some invited testimony. I will have the list to see if there's anybody here who's traveled over 100 miles, because I want to make sure that you do get up today. So we're not going to ask you to burn more fossil fuel to come back. And certainly we will give them priority. And then also if there's any legislators who I don't see immediately that would like to speak, we will make sure that they have time as well. So we will start with the first panel, which is David Vantoff, who's the Governor's Sustainability Advisor, Mike Rainey, who's the Director of the Department of Energy, and Ted Bernhardt. He was chair of the Biofuel Subcommittee of the Renewable Energy Work Group and is also an attorney for Stoll Reeves. Gentlemen. Thank you for coming today, and I'll ask David if you could lead off, please.
Thank you, Chair, Chair Barnhart, members of the Joint Committee. Boy, it's a large group up here today. Thanks for having us back. I'm going to be very brief in my introductory remarks. I kind of covered for the Energy Environment Committee at the last hearing the governor's vision around energy independence, the package of bills that he's submitted this session. But I do want to touch on it briefly, particularly we haven't had a chance to talk with the Revenue Committee about, you know, why biofuels and how does it fit into the bigger picture. And then Ted's going to talk a bit about the process involved around trying to craft this bill, and Mike is going to walk through the specific provisions. And we were happy to answer any questions, any of us, after the testimony. Coincidentally, we were asked the same question today. The governor had a rollout, a roundtable earlier today on climate change, and was asked the same question: do you time this with the presidential address, where both biofuels and climate change were prominently mentioned in the president's speech? And clearly, the time is very ripe and exciting right now, nationally, regionally, and particularly in Oregon, to try and advance energy policy and energy independence with new provisions. The biofuels piece is, real briefly, the governor's energy agenda has five pieces. One is around an electricity standard for integrating renewable energy into the utility loads. Another is the biofuels piece, which is looking at the transportation side of the equation as opposed to the electricity side. And then we've got two tax credit bills that are trying to create new incentives for moving the market more rapidly forward in Oregon, both in terms of generation of electricity and transportation fuels, but also in terms of the related manufacturing sector that will come with this emerging sector. And we're very excited about that as well, because that's a big chunk of the jobs that we're hoping will be generated will be in the related manufacturing and technology sector. So those tax credit bills, we think, are an important fit with the focus bills on electricity and transportation fuels. And then lastly, there's a bill around state lands and enabling state government to develop projects for state government purposes to help lead by example. So focusing specifically on the biofuels bill, the governor is very excited about being able to revisit this. We were also very supportive of the package that came through last session, worked with both the House and Senate to try and craft a compromise. And while we're sorry we weren't able to get it done last session, this is a top priority for the governor this session, is to make sure that we do not leave without a biofuels package for the state of Oregon. And I talked at the last hearing about the, you know, some of the opportunities around this is from an economic development perspective, is how do we create new opportunity in the state around that. And biofuels and renewable energy is one of the great bridges the governor sees in terms of how to create bridges between the rural and urban populations in the state, how to create real and lasting economic opportunities, and particularly in rural parts of the state where much of the resources that will fuel and power this whole transition, energy transition, are located and where the opportunities are. And as you'll hear from the speakers today, that will bear out. The ethanol and biodiesel facilities that are being proposed are largely being proposed in more rural parts of the state. The crops that are going to be grown to help fuel and create these fuels are going to be in the rural parts of the state. And it's a great opportunity to marry the really what the consumers in the urban parts of the state are demanding, which is cleaner fuels. There's a strong interest in renewable fuels, both from an environmental and from an energy and cost perspective. And so we're just extremely excited about passing legislation that, you know, we talk about it a lot. How do we marry and find policy that really is good for the entire state and not just for portions of it? And this bill is, example number one about how we can do that as a body. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Ted, and I'd be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you, and thank you, Ted, for coming down here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me. Chair Bernhardt. As I mentioned, I'm Ted Bernhardt. I'm the chairman of the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group Biofuel Subcommittee. And in my other life, I'm a corporate and securities attorney at Stoll Reeves and the founder of that firm's Energy Ventures Group, which focuses on the clean energy market space, and specifically biofuels is one of the subcategories that we're focused on in addition to renewable energy. And prior to that, I was a managing partner in a venture capital investment fund here in the state. Like David, I'm going to kind of keep my comments pretty short here, because I know you're going to hear a lot of qualified individuals speak over the rest of the day today and Friday, if it goes to that. There's really only two points that I wanted to emphasize today. The first is I wanted to just explain to you guys a little bit about the process that we went through in arriving at the legislation that's in front of you right now, basically so you can see how much effort has gone into this process and what was involved in getting to the stage where we are right now. And then the second is I just want to add a couple of comments in addition to what Dave said about why this bill really matters to Oregon, I think. So just jumping right into the overview process, we began working on the Renewable Energy Group over a year ago. I guess it was almost 18 months, as Jackie said. Basically, we picked up with the bill that was almost passed by the prior legislature, and the goal of the group was basically to use the work that had already been done and find a way that we could take what we had and get all of the interested parties to one table and talking ahead of a time to each other to raise their issues, discuss them, and drive towards sort of a consensus bill. And what we did is, back in the beginning of 2006, we established a subcommittee that included basically as broad of a group of interested parties as we could think of. And these included people from the agricultural community who are producing the feedstock, biofuels refiners and processors, oil production and distribution companies, prominent research institutions in Oregon that are focusing on technologies related to biofuels, representatives of the state legislature, county, city, and local governments, a wide variety of environmental organizations, as well as some of the leading business organizations who are interested in biofuels, like the Oregon Business Association and AOI, and labor groups as well. So after the committee was formed, we had nearly a year of regular monthly in-person subcommittee meetings, and in addition to that, had monthly reports and interaction with the larger renewable energy group. And basically what was done during those periods is we solicited ideas from all the various stakeholders and walked through the legislative language that's in front of you right now, sort of issue by issue and provision by provision, and found the items that we thought were consensus items and debated the controversial issues and did the best we could to come up with common ground, and then came up with what we hoped was about as close to a consensus document as possible. And we made an especially strong effort to make sure that everyone had an opportunity to comment across the entire spectrum, and actually several times we mandated that all the members submit written comments to us. And while we were doing all that, we were coordinating very closely with the governor's office and the energy department to make sure that it was consistent with what their plans were. So basically, to make a long story short, I think what you have in front of you right now is about as close as to a consensus document as is humanly possible, given the wide range of stakeholders that you have here. And it's also a very well-crafted and, I think, well-considered bill that reflects a lot of effort and thought, analysis, and debate, and a lot of technical discussions as well. So, contrary to my original expectations, I thought it was absolutely fantastic to see what emerged from this dialogue, because we got beyond the knee-jerk, no mandates, no tax, or the government has to do anything it can to support this, to a bill that, instead of, basically subsidizing what's an unprofitable industry, really turned into more of a infrastructure bill that was designed to lay the groundwork for a market-based solution for promoting this rapid growth industry. And so I was very encouraged to see that. And, as a kind of conservative securities lawyer and a classically trained Princeton economist and free market advocate, I've got to say, I hate to admit this, but I think this bill is one of the very few instances where government policy really is needed in this area, and desperately needed, and I think it'll pay off in the long term, because as an infrastructure investment for an industry where Oregon can really lead and participate in the rapid growth that's coming down the road, I think this is a great first step. We already touched on sort of the competitive advantage that I think this bill will give. Washington and California already have incentives in place, and I think it's about time that Oregon, put something in place too, so we don't lose out to our neighbors next door. I guess in conclusion, I know there's going to be changes to this bill, and it's not going to be exactly what we're looking at today, but it really is critical that something positive come out of this session to show the world that Oregon is a leader in biofuels and renewable energy and is committed to it, and that we're doing everything we can at the legislative level to live up to our reputation as an environmental and forward-looking leader in the country. And not to overstate this, but I actually think this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to handle a really tough and formerly controversial issue in a policy and business environment where, as Jackie said, sort of the left and the right, the urban and the rural, and the business and the environmentalists agree on the importance of getting something done, and all see a win coming out of this. And so really I think the question now is more not about whether this is a partisan issue or not, but it's really about an effectiveness issue and making sure that we carry this through the political process and execute on a bill that people are expecting right now. So let's go ahead and get the job done.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Graining, we're going to move on to your testimony, and then we'll take some questions from my colleagues.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chairman, and members of both committees. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As Ted said, there's a high degree of consensus from a very broad-based group of people who were involved in working this bill over the last year. Let me mention as I go through this, and I provide you two handouts. One is sort of an overview sort of slide format, and that's the one I'll actually walk through briefly. Then there's a more detailed section-by-section summary for you as well. There are some further changes we'll need. There were some drafting issues. There's some clarifications that need to be done that we'll be coming back to you on, including some issues related to the revenue impacts of the tax credits that are in here. But even with those changes, I think there's the basic structure of the bill here is what we have before you that we're proposing. So let me mention what those are. First, if you turn to page 2 of the slide presentation, there's a property tax exemption for biofuel facilities. And currently there's one in statute for ethanol production facilities that expires in, I believe, the end of 2008. This would expand that to cover all biofuel facilities, so biodiesel as well as ethanol, and extend the exemption to 2014. There's a provision for if it's located in a incorporated city for local city opt-out option, and that particular provision is still under discussion amongst the various supporters of the bill. The next major section on page 3 offers a tax credit for producers and collectors of biofuel material to be used for biofuels. This would provide an incentive for the feedstock that goes into making ethanol and biodiesel and for some solid fuel use such as wood products. The amount of the credit has to just be determined, and that so that was not factored in terms of the revenue impact of the bill. The next major sections deal with the renewable fuel standard. This is the one mandate in the bill. This would establish a requirement for both biodiesel and ethanol. For ethanol, when in-state production reaches 90 million gallons, all gasoline sold in the state must contain at least 10% ethanol. That 90 million gallons is about the volume that was used in Oregon last year, not produced but used. So when that level reaches, in-state production reaches that amount, then the mandate would kick in. Similarly for biodiesel, when biodiesel in-state production reaches 5 million gallons, and that one's tied specifically to Northwest feedstocks, biodiesel must contain at least 2% biodiesel, or B2, by volume. And when production reaches 15 million gallons, biodiesel must be B5, or 5% biodiesel. By comparison, on the next page, there's the city of Portland recently adopted a mandate for fuel sold in the city of Portland. Theirs is tied to specific target dates, whereas the approach we've taken is tied to the level of production. Their mandate would likely take effect sooner, especially for ethanol. We expect the level of ethanol under the renewable fuel standard proposed in the bill likely would kick in probably in 2008 sometime, for 2008 or 2009. For biodiesel, it would probably be roughly in the same time frame as the city of Portland. It's probably 2010 to 2012, somewhere in there. Another feature of the Portland one is when Oregon-grown canola reaches a certain level, it must be used. So again, both bills have features to encourage the use of locally grown feedstock in the mandate. Turning to page 6, there's a provision. Again, most of these provisions were in the bill last session in some form. There's prohibition on MTBE, which I'm not sure I can tell you what it stands for. It's an additive, it's an oxygenate as an alternative to ethanol. And it's very toxic. It's been outlawed in California and Washington. We don't want MTBE added fuel coming to Oregon. There are another number of other additives listed as well that would be prohibited. None of those, but MTBE is the main one. That list was developed last session and without controversy. As I recall, the petroleum suppliers, for example, were okay on this list as well, in addition to various other groups. There's also a requirement on state government to increase its use of biofuel and look for opportunities, for example, such as where currently we have backup power for diesel generation, to look at the use of biodiesel in those situations. In addition, the governor has directed the state agencies, state motor pool, and other state fleets to increase their use of biodiesel and ethanol E85. Most of the cars that the state is buying now are E85 cars, and there are E85 fueling stations at, I believe, at all the major motor pools now, at least on the west side of the state. There's also a biofuel consumer credit, turning to page 8, that would provide incentives for individuals who purchase biofuel, either B99 or ethanol E85, so it's very high standards for fuel, or for solid biofuel for very efficient home heating systems, such as the new very clean-burning wood pellet stoves. That tax credit does have a revenue impact, and we've estimated that to be about $630,000 for the next biennium. On page 9, there's a change to a bill you passed last session that we had requested. That was Senate Bill 736, I believe, that provided that certain biofuel production facilities that met certain environmental requirements, such as minimal requirements for new pipeline and other infrastructure, had already received local land use approval, and either railed or barged their input and output in to avoid traffic impacts, that could receive an exemption from our Energy Facility Siting Council instead of going through the normal Siting Council review for large energy facilities. Since then, we've seen in the Midwest a number of facilities are being built and powered, or in terms of the heat necessary for their facilities, with small coal burners. These aren't coal power plants. These are inefficient coal burners. We don't want to see that happen here. The provision in the bill by setting an efficiency standard in terms of CO2 emissions would preclude the use of coal in that process and would allow natural gas and other cleaner fuels to power those facilities in order to get the exemption. There's also a provision that would allow biofuel facilities on currently zoned EFU, exclusive farm use property. This is a provision that allows other agricultural production facilities, food processing on farms. There's a size limit for that. There's, I believe, an acreage limit as well. And this would allow the use of ethanol and biodiesel production facilities, so it would allow farmer cooperatives and small farms to build these facilities on their own property. And again, there's limits in statute as to size and scope of what can be covered there, consistent with the existing exclusive farm use statute exceptions for other farm uses. And then I've provided both the fiscal and the revenue impacts. The fiscal impacts on agency expenditures is really pretty minimal in terms of, I think, the agency's abilities to absorb the work. That's on page 11. On page 12, we have the revenue impact from the tax credit for the consumer credit for purchasing biofuels on pages 12 and 13. It does increase over time. And then, as I mentioned before, the producer credit, the last page, is a blank that would have to be filled in. And that would be determined by the level of revenue impact that the committee's thought acceptable. That, Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions or explain further after you hear from other witnesses.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Rainey. And I just want to point out for the committee members that for those of you who were here last session, many of these elements should be familiar. There's been some tweaking done, and we could also provide a side-by-side comparison if that would be helpful to you. I do want to point out that the renewable fuel standard has been changed in that there has been a sort of in-state production trigger that was added, And last session, the bills that we had had a renewable fuel standard that was based on the time, basically the date certain, and this is triggered to production, and it doesn't have any dates attached to it. So that's something that's markedly different. At this time, I'd like to entertain a few questions. We do have three other panels. As you see, we have lots of people here to testify, so I'm going to say if you have really burning questions, please ask them. If it's something that you can spend some more time with the Department of Energy in your offices, I'll also encourage you to do that as well, because these bills are complicated, and we will need to go through all of the sections carefully. Yeah. Vice Chair Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your leadership on this very important issue. And, gentlemen, I really appreciate your time and effort, and many others in this room that spent a lot of time during the interim working on this. A couple quick questions, and I believe Mr. Graney will be able to address the first one when we meet Friday morning. But one of the things I noticed when I read this, and I understand this is focused on biofuel, but the concern I have, one of the other, and of course near and dear to me, is the biomass issue, especially on the east side of the mountains. And a lot of the tax credits that we have in here, for example, the credit for those that collect the biomass and deliver it to a biofuel facility, doesn't include if they deliver it to a facility that converts it into electricity. So I'd like to either figure out how are we going to do that in this bill, or what vehicle would we use to be able to provide that same type of credit there, so we've got some equity. The only thing I'd be interested in hearing from folks, especially Bernhard, for your did you and your committee have discussions about any sort of preemption clause in here vis-a-vis the Portland standard?
We did discuss that topic, yeah, and I think the general answer is that we're very happy with what's being done in Portland, and we just want to make sure that if we're putting something in place, that we don't undermine what's going on there, that it's either the same sorts of standards or broader. So.
Mr. Graney, did you want to, can you quickly address it, or do you want to?
Just to mention two things, Representative Burley, and we will follow up with you on that, because the issue of providing incentives for biomass was included in the discussions as well. But another bill, House Bill 2211, the Business Energy Tax Credit, will provide an increase in both the percentage of credit from 35 to 50% and the eligible cost per project from $10 to $20 million. And biomass energy facilities, electricity facilities, and other facilities using wood or wood wastes would qualify for that. And that, I think, will be a significant incentive for the types of projects you're looking for.
And for my committee members, we'll be hearing those bills next Monday, and you'll be hearing those bills eventually. So just so you know, it's on your radar screen. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I appreciate this opportunity to ask questions. As for some of us, this is a new bill. And I don't have a question for folks here, but for whoever's going to come address. In Section 15, there's a comment that requires that all diesel fuel sold in Oregon must include biodiesel, and that was part of your overview. And I'm not looking for an answer here. I'm looking for when the panel comes up. I need to know the difference in air emission between a standard vehicle that runs on gasoline versus one that runs with this mix. And so if whoever's going to come address us in the future, if you know the answer to that, I'd love to hear it. Thank you.
Anybody up here? I don't know if just to mention the governor's office can address that.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, biodiesel runs substantially cleaner than regular diesel, and we can get you information on that, I'm sure, from the Department of Environmental Quality.
Can I ask a follow-up question then?
Follow-up, Representative Smith.
And again, I'm new to this issue. I apologize to the committee members for this. I just want to make sure I'm knowledgeable on this. So is that part of the logic in when this bill was drafted, was that part of the logic in having that mandate? Of requiring from going from traditional diesel to the biodiesel was because it is significantly cleaner?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think that's one of the benefits. I think the mandate is more important in terms of building the market for in-state this industry in terms of both production facilities to be built that are capital intensive and for the agricultural industry to benefit from the use of these products that can be turned into fuel. But there are benefits in terms of air quality as well.
Mr. Vanthoff.
And Chair Representative Smith, I would just add that I think from the governor's office perspective, we think of it as three really integrated, and you can't really just take one out and say this is why we're doing it. The three pieces to us is economic development, which we've already covered. Second is energy independence, which relates to economic development. And the third is the air quality and climate change issues that it leads towards, and that those three are very intimately connected, and we're hearing about it. From President Bush, from Congress, across the country, that those are the three drivers for why these bills are being proposed and moving forward.
Okay. I'm just struggling with the social engineering that's going on here, and so I'm trying to figure out the benefits of the farmers. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I think we'll also hear from the agricultural community in a little bit, and they may be able to share with us how this will help, if this will help their industry. Any questions from this side? Representative Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question
is, I want to be playing favorites of my committee, so I make sure you get
the time.
I'll look here first next time, I promise.
Sure, be sure to look left.
Yes, I often do, so I rarely accused of not looking left. So.
Really? Okay, you've stumped me. All right. Ted?
Yes.
Okay. This question is kind of directed to you, but the panel can chip in on it, too.
Sure.
Some of the comments that you had in your testimony that government policy is really needed here. So I'm not a real mandate type person.
Right.
But I understood this where we were at last session, and I liked it.
Yep.
The other thing, too, is that you mentioned you don't want to lose out to our neighbors with what they're doing. And I've done some studying on this, and I know that there's a huge ethanol industry just climbing all over the nation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that now, I'm just curious, is it a real fledging industry for us here in this state? And do you really feel with everything else that's going on that we should probably even mandate this now with that? So.
Well, yes, I think it is a real fledgling industry in the state, as you'll hear from some of the other people that are offering testimony today. And, what I think the key point here is that there isn't really a universal biofuels industry. I mean, there's ethanol and biodiesel, and there are geographic differences in terms of business models that make sense and distribution models and things like that. And the beauty of this bill and why I think it's necessary is that it's been specifically tailored to help Oregon find its competitive advantage in this industry. And the incentives in here have been, put in here because they're incenting things that are in the long term going to allow us to compete effectively and both with our neighbors to the north and the south and across the country, and have a sustainable business model that's profitable and ultimately not dependent upon government support.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. If there are not any other burning questions, I do see Andy Ginsberg, who is the director of the Air Division for DEQ, and I'm wondering if, Andy, could you come up for 2 minutes and address the air emissions issue?
We're here. I have a quick clarification on a previous statement.
Sure. Representative Beyer.
And they didn't give me a microphone. I don't think they wanted me to talk. Or they figure I never talk, so they won't give me one. I don't know.
You would never assume that, Representative Beyer.
Earlier when you talked, when the question about preemption was asked, and the statement was that we decided we didn't want to do that, I think was kind of a paraphrase. Was that a consensus we from the group, or a how was that we? Who is that we, I guess?
Well, just to follow up on what I said before, I don't think we actually reached an official conclusion on that. The issue was certainly raised, and I think that there were a variety of opinions based on the diversity of the committee, but the general consensus was that people were happy to see what was happening in Portland, and to the extent that the state could complement that, that would be a good thing. But that's about as far as we got.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Andy.
Yes. Madam Chair, I have a question that would be appropriate to put to somebody with legal expertise, and I'm not sure whether we have people in later panels.
You have an attorney from your law firm.
That's what
right
I'm
here,
thinking. Might be the.
I love it. Mr. Bernard,
let you make that call.
On the firing line. Well, here's my question, and it is that I see in the outline we were just walked through, there's a reference to when canola production reaches a certain level, then it must be used as 50% of the renewable fuel standard for biodiesel. My question is, I can't find that in the bill language. To what extent can we require an Oregon source in a renewable fuel standard, or do we run into interstate commerce kinds of issues as to place of origin?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think that language is in the city bill, not the state bill.
Right.
So that's why you're not seeing that there. And as you know, up in Washington, they did run into some of these issues, and it takes some pretty careful crafting to make sure that we aren't running afoul of the interstate commerce issues. And what I think the approach that we were coming down towards was more of a regional approach rather than a just one specific state, so that the source could be within the West Coast rather than just within Oregon on some of these things.
Follow up if I could. So yep. the conclusion then is that if we couldn't say just has to be Oregon source, but we could say Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, we could say that will be the source of the grain stock or other the fuel source.
That's kind of where we're going, because that puts a little bit of a different spin on the interstate commerce issue, but that's something that wasn't fully resolved, actually, and I think Washington is still wrestling with that. And so in the context of looking at these mandates, we need to make sure that it's crafted in a way that it's not going to be subject to challenge going forward.
Okay, and I compliment you on the use of the term different spin. It sounds like you're encroaching on the political side of things.
And I hope you two won't bill each other for this conversation. Just don't bill the states, okay? Yes.
Chair Dinkler, Representative McPherson, is a former attorney from your law. I won't be speaking as a lawyer here, but I think one other thing to keep in mind is that by crafting as the Pacific Northwest, really the focus was is Canadian canola and grains coming from out of the country, and we're clearly okay with respect to the Interstate Commerce Clause on that one. I don't think anybody in this room can clearly define for you exactly where the Commerce Clause is going to draw the line, but we think that Pacific Northwest is certainly a safer place to be than just an Oregon grown, and that was kind of the discussion we had at the committee level.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen has a question for the panel.
Thank you. As a follow-up to on this, and I think you addressed part of it, but the question was with canola and Canada and NAFTA, and that's not really the Pacific Northwest, where then most of that's going, if I understand what's going on in Canada correctly.
And Representative Jensen, we have the Department of Agriculture that will be coming up, so we may want to pose that question to them as well. So, Andy, can you come up, can you address the air emissions briefly for folks? And make sure you state your name, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, for the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. Of course, the primary air quality benefit from biofuels is reducing the net carbon dioxide emissions that contribute to global warming, but I believe your question is about other air pollutants. With regard to the biodiesel, with diesel emissions, the primary thing we're concerned about with air quality is particulate emissions or the smoke. And you'll be hearing another bill that we have the clean diesel bill that will provide incentives for putting on particle filters to reduce those emissions. And we need to have low sulfur fuel to do that. And the biofuels are low sulfur, so it's fully compatible with our air quality goals. The biofuels also will result in lower toxic emissions. So it's all, in terms of the biodiesel, it's fully compatible. With ethanol, it's a slightly more complicated story, but net environmental positive from our perspective. The ethanol does, in certain concentrations, it increases the amount of gasoline that will evaporate, and that can increase emissions. But fortunately, in Oregon, with our air quality, that's not going to cause us any problems. What ethanol does is it improves the combustion. You get less toxic air pollutants as well, less carbon monoxide. So overall, it's the ethanol and the biodiesel are going to be positive air quality benefit in addition to the carbon dioxide.
Okay.
reduction.
So, just follow up.
Quickly. This will be the last one, and then we need to move on to the other panel.
And the reason I'm asking this question, as I read the bill, I understand the carrots in it. I'm trying to figure out why we have the stick, if I may use that analogy. And maybe is this the stick? Is this why we're doing this, because of the air emissions issue that we're going to require this, or is that just one component of many?
It's one component. Representative Smith, you will also hear in a minute when I invite the panel up of industry folks who will give us a little more information about how their industry is doing and how this will affect their industry. So I think
Wonderful.
It's a combination.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Apologize for the lawyer jokes, but I can't help myself.
Got us outnumbered.
Okay. First, I just want to check. We don't have anybody signed up that is here from 100 miles or greater, except for our senator from Washington. But I want to check if there's anybody else who would like to come up and testify that has driven over 100 miles. And I don't see any legislators, current legislators, in there in the audience. So I'm going to call up the next panel, which is former State Representative Jeff Krupp. He is Executive Director of the Northwest Renewable Fuels Association. Thomas Endicott, who's manager of the Eugene Office of Sequential Biofuels. Chuck Carlson is president of Cascade Grain Products. And Paul Kohler, who is with Pacific Ethanol. And I see we have four chairs, so one of you will have to fight over sharing the mics. Just a reminder that we have two other panels behind you, so I'm going to ask if you can keep your comments to 5 minutes or so. And again, we will hold questions until after the panel. It is a pleasure to see you, Jeff, on the other side of the dais.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I've been here before, but I'm your body, so I hope that I have not built up, let's say, paybacks. I'm actually, if it would please the chair, I would prefer to be last in today's discussion. To kind of give you the industry perspective as an association. And with that, Madam Chair, I present to you my friend Thomas Endicott.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart. Thomas Endicott, Managing Partner of Sequential Biofuels, not just the Eugene office, Portland as well. Before I dive in here, I just want to say I was reviewing my testimony last night to this committee from 2005 legislative session and the 2003 legislative session, and I am very excited and hopeful that this time, the third time around, will be the charm in this 07 legislative session. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the expediency of bringing this bill before the committee. Sequential Biofuels is an Oregon-based biofuels distribution and retail company with offices in Portland and Eugene. In fact, founded in Representative Barnhart's district down there in 2002. Sequential provides commercial biodiesel and biodiesel petroleum diesel blends to businesses, governments, and individuals through cardlock facilities, retail pumps, and affiliated bulk fuel outlets throughout Oregon. Since 2002, Sequential has distributed more than 3 million gallons of pure biodiesel throughout its network of distributors in both Oregon and Washington. Sequential Pacific Biodiesel is a joint venture between Sequential Biofuels and Pacific Biodiesel of Maui, Hawaii. That group has operated Oregon's only commercial biodiesel production facility located here in Salem since July of 2005. In fact, we were just on the verge of beginning production when I gave testimony in 05. The 1 million gallon per year facility processes predominantly used cooking oil that's collected from restaurants and food processors throughout the Pacific Northwest region. In 2006, we also processed 20,000 gallons, the first 20,000 gallons, of Oregon-grown, Oregon-crushed canola oil from the Pendleton-Hermiston area. And we anticipate more of that product coming to the plant this year. This year, Sequential Pacific Biodiesel will expand the production capacity of its Salem plant from 1 million gallons to 5 million gallons per year. So the industry is growing. On to the bill. Sequential Biofuels does support HB 2210, and as an Oregon business and corporate citizen, Sequential believes that the production and consumption of biofuels, biodiesel, ethanol, and other biomass fuels in Oregon creates the social, economic, and environmental impacts that the legislature should encourage and should support. Specifically, when I testified to this committee, before this committee on April 19th of 2005, I explained that in order for the biofuels industry to benefit Oregon's economy and the environment to the greatest extent possible, a successful law would need to include two things. First being a stable market in Oregon for biofuels producers to fill, and the second being incentives to keep feedstocks produced by Oregon farmers and Oregon forest products industries competitive with feedstocks produced outside of Oregon. The intent of HB 2210 in its current form does achieve both these goals. However, I'll suggest that it could be more effective with a few amendments to the bill. First and foremost, Sequential supports the implementation of a renewable fuel standard at the levels designated in the bill, and this is the guaranteed market piece of what's required. Furthermore, Sequential believes that using verified volumes of in-state production as trigger points is the correct way to proceed, not using volumes specific or dates specifically, and that thereby guarantees that the RFS provision will create jobs and tax revenue in Oregon. Sequential is satisfied with the specified volumes that trigger an RFS for each fuel, for gasoline and diesel. However, in Section 15 and 18 of the bill, biodiesel and ethanol are treated differently. Whereas the trigger volume of biodiesel would be required to be processed from feedstocks collected or harvested within a four-state region, as you just heard discussed, the ethanol provision has no such regional feedstock requirement. And I'm not saying that we're against regional feedstocks at all. I'm simply saying those two are treated differently. Sequential does not believe that the source of feedstock for biodiesel and ethanol production to trigger the RFS should be held a different standard, and we would request that specific piece of the regional requirement be removed. I actually believe it's not really necessary. To play on the discussion of the Portland RFS, we do believe strongly that the statewide RFS should be coordinated with the Portland RFS and work together. In addition, the City of Portland has made great strides in working with state agencies and fuel distributors in Portland to develop an implementation plan for that RFS, which is set to begin July 1 of this year. 5% biodiesel and 10% ethanol. On to the regional feedstock piece, which is very important to us. Sequential adamantly supports the use of regional feedstocks for biofuel production, and we strive to give preference to those feedstocks collected or harvested in the Pacific Northwest region. Let me add on, although used cooking oil remains available in the region, and that's our main source of supply today, it is a finite supply, and there is increasing competition for that product because it is readily available today. Agricultural oilseed crops like canola and mustard present the only real opportunity to expand Pacific Northwest feedstocks for biodiesel production within the next 5 years. However, in order to be competitive in the overall biofuels market and to compete with biofuels coming in from the Midwest and elsewhere, biofuels producers like ourselves, Sequential Pacific Biodiesel, must use cost-effective feedstock to the greatest extent possible. Feedstocks collected or harvested in the Pacific Northwest must be competitive within a range in order for us to be competitive producing biodiesel, competitive with feedstocks in other parts of the U.S. or other parts of the world. Oregon-grown canola or mustard for biodiesel production is currently more expensive than soybean oil from the Midwest, canola oil from Canada, or palm oil from Asia. It's not that we are less efficient at doing this because the industry is so young here in this region. We can do a lot better. We can move up to that level, but it's going to take time and a little bit of support. The fledgling oilseed industry in Oregon needs a leg up to acquire the scale and efficiency of other vegetable oil producing regions of North America. Currently, canola grown and crushed in eastern Oregon, and believe me, these operations are very small right now. It can be as much as $1 per gallon premium over soybean oil from the Midwest. As I say, that is not a permanent piece at all. That's the situation today, and over time we can help bring that difference down. For this reason, we believe that Section 6 of HB 2210 is the most critical section of this bill in terms of guaranteeing that Oregon agricultural producers benefit from the growth of the biofuels industry. And the comments about economic development, this has been the discussion for the last 5 years about economic development for agricultural producers and businesses in Oregon, that this is a boon for the Oregon economy. Providing a tax credit of up to $8 per million BTUs to Oregon feedstock producers and collectors will allow biodiesel producers like Sequential Pacific Biodiesel to include Oregon-grown oilseed crops in a cost-competitive mix of feedstocks for biodiesel production. This tax credit for biomass feedstocks can also create opportunities to include Oregon-grown wheat as a competitive feedstock for ethanol production. And obviously, we have a very large production of wheat in Oregon. And I will also add that under Section 9 of the bill, we very much support assigning responsibility to the Oregon Department of Energy to determine the specific dollar rates for each specific feedstock. So that $8 per million BTU is not across the board. That's a maximum. The Department of Energy would determine what's reasonable for each particular feedstock. Further in the bill, we absolutely support Section 1 providing property tax abatement for siting biofuels production facilities. And we do not support the option of districts to opt out. We really feel like it would be best to have that be across the board, all tax districts in Oregon. Tax savings for a limited period of time, for a five-year period of time, would create an incentive for companies to site their facilities in Oregon while providing more financial flexibility for small and medium-sized businesses in an industrial sector that requires significant capitalization, and that is an important part. These facilities are very expensive to build. I want to commend the state for its use of biofuels and really taking a lead in showing how easy and dependable they are, especially Oregon Department of Transportation that's been using 20% biodiesel for the last 3 years. Also, the state motor pool in its drive to use actually put 85% ethanol in its flex fuel vehicles. To wrap up here, Section 24, absolutely individuals should be rewarded for using high blends of biofuels, and the siting for facilities on and off farm makes sense. Finally, I'm sure you'll receive testimony from other organizations that will sit right here at this table and raise questions about biofuel quality, limitations of distribution infrastructure, and increasing cost of motor fuels when biofuels are added to them. And let me first say that although instituting this RFS in Oregon is absolutely politically progressive, from a technical perspective, it is very, very simple. Keep in mind throughout this process that Minnesota has maintained 10% ethanol RFS for all gasoline in Minnesota since 1993. It's also instituted a 2% biodiesel RFS that began in the fall of 2005. So we're not creating anything new here, and there are great examples of how Minnesota's done this, both from legislation, which I think a lot of what we're doing here is modeled after that, also from implementation and agency oversight. There are longstanding ASTM fuel quality standards for both biodiesel and ethanol, and all commercial producers adhere to these standards. No question about that. Same as for gasoline or diesel fuel in their standards. And there are, of course, precedents for state agency oversight for monitoring fuel quality. All the Portland fuel terminals today have the necessary infrastructure to blend ethanol with gasoline. They've been doing that since November 1st of 1992. Since that time, Portland's oxygenate mandate, presided over by EPA and DEQ, has required 7.8% ethanol in all gasoline in the Portland metro area between November and February. So again, taking an E10 RFS is very easy. Technically, the infrastructure is already there. In terms of biodiesel and ethanol blending outside the Portland area, there will be cost to install additional tankage and blending infrastructure, but the cost of that equipment is really minimal when it's amortized over the life of the equipment and the sheer volume of fuel that goes through those terminals. And finally, blending gasoline with 10% ethanol and blending diesel with 2% or 5% biodiesel will have insignificant impact on the price of motor fuels in Oregon, far less than the impact of daily price swings caused by volatile pricing of crude. Every time crude moves a dollar or two, our prices are moving around, and also supply disruptions in the Pacific Northwest, which we've seen in the last couple of years. So I thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee, and we appreciate your continued support of this biofuels bill as it moves through the legislature for the third time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Endicott. Before we move on to Mr. Carlson, I just want to remind folks that buzzing that we hear is if anybody has a cell phone or a BlackBerry on, so please turn it off because it interferes with our sound system. And many of you probably put it on vibrate. But please turn it off. Thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, members of the Joint Committee. My name is Charles Carlson. I'm the President and CEO of Cascade Grain Products. We're a 113-million-gallon ethanol plant that will be online. It's under construction now, online roughly in about a year. Between us and Pacific Ethanol, this combined volume will be enough to make a 10% blend for in-state production throughout the state. So we're getting there. We're growing. And as Thomas said, his third session, my third session. So we've been working at this for a long time. Cascade grain, it will be used corn from the Midwest. We basically are tapping into a little bit of the corn that's coming through the Pacific Northwest already that exports between 20 and 25% of the U.S. corn exports. We will create a distiller dry grain product for the local livestock use, which is a high protein product that goes very well for dairy and other feeds, so we will provide a local source for that. Oregon and Washington specifically are a net deficit area for corn. We, with even taking away from the ethanol side, we have to import corn for local domestic uses. So it's not, right now, we don't even produce enough for our local demand. When we talk about overall use of ethanol right now, we have, there's 111 plants currently operating. There's another over 70 under construction. That total production right now is 1.1 billion, roughly 1.4. It changes almost a daily, which is far and above the 7.5 billion gallon mandate that was in the 2005 energy bill. And again, as the president has said, we are moving this to a much higher level in last year's State of the Union. Where can we get with corn specifically? You're probably looking at that 13 to 15 billion gallon area. That's where you use roughly about a third of the corn crop. We can increase the corn acres, and price pushes those acres around. Right now there's over 400 million acres in field and fallow. In some of the consultant reports that we use, we estimate that corn acres will have to increase by the time we hit those kind of numbers in the high 90 to 100 million acres. If you look back 100 years, we grew over 100 million acres of corn. So we're coming back to that. We allocate our acres based on the rate of return the farmers receive, and they're very good at readjusting those acres. And with the price ratios where they are right now, you will see a pretty sizable increase in corn acres in the U.S. this coming year. At the cost, reduction of wheat acres, reduction of the price of soybean acres. That reflects back to prices that are received here. This year, we're seeing $5 white wheat prices. It's about time. It's been a long time. So U.S. agriculture does not work in, it works in a globe, in a globe of multiple commodities, and each of one affects other commodities. So as we use corn from the Midwest, we help our local producers here and provide distilled dry grains for our livestock industry. So we're here. We are producing. We'll be producing ethanol next year. We need a market for it. How do we go beyond a 10% blend in cellulosic ethanol? And we have limits, and that will come from field, agricultural residue, forestry products, municipal solid waste. Actually, from a U.S. aspect, when we talk to going to a 35 billion gallon, municipal solid waste is probably the biggest contributor into that, because agricultural residue, being a farmer running co-ops before, you need that in your agricultural residue to a certain extent in the soil profile. You need it for organic material. And also, there is, when you talk about from a cellulosic ethanol standpoint, the garbage truck can deliver every day. So that's where a lot of the emphasis is being put right now, on a gasification process to convert municipal solid waste to ethanol. And when we get into cellulosic ethanol, whether it's municipal solid waste, ryegrass, that's where Oregon can see a lot of local feedstock going into some very good benefits. It's drastically reducing stuff, material that's going to landfills, where we can see that powering one of the cycles that they look at is tie one of those cellulosic ethanol plants on the front end of a corn grain ethanol plant to provide the electrical and the steam requirements for that plant. It makes both of them more efficient. So we have a lot of things that are happening in this industry, and cellulosic ethanol is moving along. Pilot plants are running. Actually, commercial plants start under construction this year. So we have a industry that's moving forward. The renewable fuel standard is necessary for a market. It's from an environmental aspect, from every aspect you look at. It's a plus for the economy, plus for the state. So I recommend that you move forward with 2210, as I've been recommending for bills through the last three sessions.
I hear a common theme here. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mr. Curler?
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder and Chair Barnhart. My name is Paul Curler, Vice President of Business Development for Pacific Ethanol. Pacific Ethanol owns and operates a ethanol production facility in Madera, California, and also in Windsor, Colorado. We have a project under construction in Boardman, Oregon, a 35 million gallon plant in which we expect to be commercial in July of this year. So we're very pleased to be here in the state, being able to produce, and we certainly encourage a bill like this to pass through the legislature and support the market that we are just beginning to create ourselves, Cascade, Sequential Biodiesel, and there will be other firms that come into this market with the nature of the support that this bill provides. It'll provide a backstop in which investment can be made for technology, as Chuck is talking about with cellulosic investments. It's going to be a backstop that farmers can make for investment in their crops, for feedstocks, and it will be a backstop for investment in infrastructure so that we can be marketing ethanol fuels and biofuels into Oregon economy. Without this type of bill, I would suspect that some of the ethanol that we produce, that Cascade produces, would flow to other regions, other states. California will be demanding increasing amounts of ethanol fuels. Washington has a mandate, and the commodity will flow where the market is most present. So in a nutshell, that is largely the reason why we at Pacific Ethanol are fully supportive of this bill and really encourage its passage in the legislature. Our Boardman plant, just to give you a profile, will employ 35 employees, 35 people. Full-time, during construction, we'll have over 100 people on site. I was there yesterday. It's really quite impressive. It's wonderful to see the cement in the ground, the steel going up. The columns are up. The rail is laid. It's happening. So it's very, very exciting. It's a great thing for that economy. It's a great boost. We'll produce about 40 million gallons of ethanol, and we'll also produce 350,000 tons a year of feed for the local livestock, primarily cows and the dairy and the feedstocks. The other stuff that I wanted to address here has already been stated in terms of the air quality effects, and sensitive to the time here. But we're very, very pleased to be in Oregon and very pleased to be fielding this plant here. We expect to do more business in the Northwest, in Oregon, and having a bill like 2210 is going to support our efforts. So we really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jeff, if you could wrap up, and then we'll have some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. I will try to be brief, and I know you all realize how much of a challenge that is. You should have our handout, or it's being handed out quickly to you from the Northwest Renewable Fuels Association. There are four main benefits to House Bill 2210 and the ensuing bills that you will be divining over perhaps a bit later, and they're being placed in front of you right now. Number one is cleaner air. I don't think there's anyone on the earth who is against cleaner air, and that's a true benefit of all of the effort of these gentlemen in this entire direction, and clearly the president. By the way, I will say that I will take credit for the president saying last night, I crap the White House. No, I didn't. Isn't it fortuitous, though, that the president comes out last night and says, I want a standard, a mandate, that is five times greater than what it is today. Now, 2 years ago, when Congress passed that mandate at 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol in this nation, we're almost already there 5 years early, because the marketplace is accepting it, because these gentlemen have had a vision for so long, and it's caught on. But also for other reasons, and we'll get into that down the road. Cleaner air is a marvelous benefit. also a tremendously positive impact on rural economic development. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer, and I will also say, Madam Chair, to put all of my cards on the table, that I'm not only a fifth-generation Oregon farmer, but I intend as a farmer to benefit from the provisions of this bill, number one. Number two, I'm also an investor in a biofuels company, and I intend to see that investment grow and produce benefit for all. Rural economic development will be an awesome benefit and a desperately needed benefit, not only in America, but right here in Oregon. I've had the honor over the last year serving on the National Conference of State Legislatures as the chairman of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee. And we've talked about how we can integrate into rural development biofuels production at the federal level. Tomorrow I'll be leaving on my way to Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress over the next few days about increasing the level of participation, which the President said last night, in the upcoming 2007 Farm Bill for biofuels, specifically for rural development. It is a direction that Congress is going, it's a direction the President is going, and it's a direction that we need to go in this state. And this bill helps us get there. It reduces reliance on foreign oil. And this is a powerfully personal issue for me. I just came home from Afghanistan. I'm wearing a lapel pin that is the Afghanistan flag and the American flag together, visiting our Oregon National Guard troops that are doing some marvelous work over there, making a positive difference in creating hope for that nation. And one of the things there that I learned is our people over there are all volunteers, our 900 Oregon National Guardsmen. They feel very powerfully and very strongly about the issue of why they're there. They're there, as many of the soldiers told me, because Afghanistan is where most of the 9/11 hijackers were trained, funded by petrodollars. Those soldiers, and me as an American, I'm tired that every time I fill up my gas tank today, I'm putting money in the pocket of a terrorist. Reducing dependence on foreign oil will stop that. And I feel very strongly about that as an American for me and my family and the future national security of this nation. It also means that we're not subject to the whims of petroleum-exporting countries who organize and decide, as OPEC is deciding to do right now, or talking about right now, rather, reducing the supply in the marketplace. It helps us overcome that. Why? Well, because it actually gets to the fourth bullet point, and that is lower prices at the pump. This bill helps create the competitive model, all of it put together, that creates greater competition. And we all know what the benefits of greater competition to you, to your constituents, is lower prices, because your people are competing for your business. Those are the four main benefits out of this bill. And I will tell you that I think so many of the challenges that you will hear about that are legitimate are challenges that you can help solve. You will hear many things about good things out of this legislation. You will hear things that are not so good, in the opinion of some. And I would ask that you carefully consider all of those arguments. Keep in mind one thing. Let's keep our eye on the prize. And the eye on the prize is cleaner air, stronger rural economic development, reducing our reliance on foreign oil, not putting money in the pockets of terrorists, and reducing the price at the pump. Now, I'm not the only one who says that reducing the price at the pump is, in fact, a real benefit of this. You have on the last page of your handout a copy of this article from Reuters, and the headline is, "More ethanol means lower gasoline prices," from the American Petroleum Institute. In fact, the lowest prices, if you go on AAA's website today, I did 3 days ago, the lowest prices of gasoline in the state of Oregon today are in the Portland metro area, where it just so happens they're blending ethanol with fuel. That was true this month, it was true last month, it was true a year ago. Again, where you create greater competition, and this bill and the accompanying bills help create the marketplace for local production from local feedstocks. And that is how we will meet the challenges that the President and Congress have clearly, the direction they've clearly articulated, This is how we can help accomplish them. And right now, by the way, I will say that Oregon agriculture is benefiting from the national movement towards biofuels. You know how? I'm a grass seed farmer, fifth generation. Right now, Canada is growing more canola. Why? Because they want to sell it in the marketplace. There's a demand for it for biodiesel. Minnesota, which grows grass seed that competes with my varieties, is taking acres of grass seed out. Why? Because they're planting corn, because corn prices have risen. That has the benefit to me as an Oregon farmer. My grass seed prices have come up, and they've stabilized. We're making a profit again. And as the dynamics of this bill come into place, and as this lays the foundation for the next generation of technology, which these gentlemen are planning for, and they've talked about, and that is cellulosic breakdown, that's biomass, from my grass seed straw, from Representative Burley's forestry products, from the municipal solid waste. That technology is very close. Very, very close. It's a couple of years away, and that's why we need to get on board now. And that's why we strongly encourage that you will consider carefully the provisions of this bill, and again, all of the arguments and the great benefits of it. And with that, Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, gentlemen. Really appreciate you all being here. We're going to take about 5 minutes for questions. We're running behind. I have some folks that I definitely want to make sure we hear from today, but I will see if we have any questions. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, and with your indulgence, I have two questions, and I think the first is for Mr. Endicott, and that is, can you confirm or explain whether B2 and B5 blends will have any effect on engine warranties? Is there a chance that they will be voided?
There is a important federal law that was back in, I think it was maybe back in the 70s, where engine manufacturers do not warrant fuel. So fuel does not, never will void a warranty. They design the engine on spec, diesel fuel spec for diesel engines, gasoline spec for gasoline engines, and B2 and B5 are strictly additives to diesel fuel. In fact, by weights and measurement standards here in Oregon, they are diesel fuel, the same way that 10% ethanol is gasoline. So they are exactly the same product as far as the engine manufacturers are concerned. When you go beyond B5, then you're into a territory that's still being explored. There are a tremendous number of vehicles out there burning higher blends. But B2, B5, diesel fuel.
And Chair Dingfelder, follow-up. Actually, and this is to the ethanol producers. I'm wondering if you can give some sense of what kind of investment you'll need to make in order to capitalize on the possibilities that cellulosic ethanol presents to us. Knowing that this technology is still a little bit down the road, what kinds of upgrades, facility, capital investment will you need to make when the time comes?
Well, cellulosic right now, if you look at it from a cost basis, is about three times higher in cost for capital structure than a corn ethanol plant. That is, you know, when I say we'll put it on the front end, you probably add the cellulosic and to the add in addition to the corn because of the additional benefits it will provide by joining them together. So the initial capital cost is about two to three times greater than a corn ethanol plant. Depending upon what they've done with a lot of the enzymes now, they're coming down dramatically in price. That's why it's getting competitive. 3 years ago, you had 5 years ago, you had about $3 plus conversion cost when you're talking cellulosic. Now it's in the realm of where it's about $1 a gallon. So that has improved a lot.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Cannon, this is a compilation off the internet of individuals, engine manufacturers, vehicle manufacturers that warrant their engines with a B5 blend of biodiesel specifically if they meet the ASTM D6751 standard. And it's Caterpillar, Cummins, Daimler, Chrysler, Detroit Diesel, Ford, General Motors, International Truck, John Deere, New Holland, Volkswagen, fuel injection equipment manufacturers, Bosch, Delphi, Stanadon.
Jeff, could we get a copy of that?
Certainly, yes.
We'll,
I'd be
we'll
happy
make copies
to provide that with you.
Thank you.
And that's clearly a concern. The next level will be beyond moving beyond to B10, B20 blends and what impacts they have And it's, I believe the industry will certainly adapt as the demand in the marketplace moves in that particular direction. They'll have to work at it. They'll have to do some additional testing, obviously, I think, to get there. But right now, B5 in terms of biodiesel is acceptable by all of these. Thank you.
Just briefly to address Representative Cannon's point on the cellulose, there's going to be companies like ourselves or Chuck's are going to invest millions of dollars in investment. We're still in the R&D phase on cellulose. In order for us to make such investments, again, we need to see have a view to a market. And therefore, the president's speech last night was very hopeful for that because he has talked about technology. He talked about creating a market. This bill does the same thing.
Thank you. Representative Burley had a quick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, one of the concerns I have coming from what is probably the more colder parts of the state, as I think some other folks in this panel might also share that, I've heard that biodiesel has a higher gel point or higher freezing point or whatever the technical term is. Is that something we should be concerned with at the B2, B5 rate, or is that something you don't really start experiencing until you get up into the B90 plus range?
Well, it's not something you're going to experience in B2, B5. As long as the biodiesel meets the ASTM spec, which Jeff just mentioned, 6751, you're not going to have any trouble at all. It can be winterized down way below zero. I believe B20 has been winterized to 40 below. So B2 and B5 are going to act just like diesel in terms of cold weather operation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from this side of the dais? Any other questions, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome to Morrow County. Welcome to Boardman. Welcome to District 57.
Do you want to mention that the plant...
You're actually going to be neighbors with multiple facilities at the Port of Morrow.
Okay.
There's five or six facilities under consideration there. Have you had a chance to read House Bill 2210, gentlemen?
Absolutely.
Okay. What would be the effect on your operations if Section 19, the mandate for Oregonians, was removed?
Well, if you take away the mandate or the marketplace, as you're saying, basically, you're going to go to where their existing use is right now, which is primarily up in Washington. You can go down to California, where they are mandating use. You know, we have seen we saw this market improve as we saw the winter funding program and its development through the years. And as that program was in place, we saw people go to year-round blending because of economics. If you take away the requirement, you can lose that market, and it's vital to have a market to have this industry here.
Just a follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is ethanol not at a point where we can let consumers decide what they want to purchase and what they are going to be mandated to purchase?
You know, it would be nice if the consumer had that choice. It's done at the petroleum blending rack. It's not done by the consumer. You know, in Brazil, which has the 25% mandate, you know, the 31,000 stations that they have in Brazil about the same amount offer both ethanol or gasoline. You just can't do that at your local station. Make your own determination. It has to be blended by the distributor or the refiner. So the consumer does not have that choice. That's why we have to have a mandate.
Just one last comment, then I'll...
Final follow-up, Representative Smith.
Thank you. You've stated that if we don't provide Section 19, that the fuel source will go to where the market is. Does it trouble you at all that we're going to tell Oregonians that they must purchase your fuel because you're going to be providing it for us?
Well... Right now, it provides environmental benefits. You know, we reduce the cost of gasoline at the pumps. You know, if without a mandate, the petroleum industry doesn't have to blend it. You know, we may see a federal mandate coming based on some of the speeches made again last night. But it'll go to other places where the current mandate is, and we know that it's blended there. You know,
so. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may also add with that, The same arguments if the free market doesn't do it, we shouldn't do it at all, is the argument the automobile industry used for many, many years not to put airbags in cars. I spent 12 years in the fire service as a volunteer fireman, and I know that Andy Olson, as a state trooper, has been to a lot of car wrecks where airbags have saved people's lives. I only wish that an air side curtain airbag had been in my niece's 1999 Jeep Cherokee because she was killed 2 days before Thanksgiving because it wasn't there. I would have loved to have paid the extra money for that mandate. In this case, we have a mandate with lots of incentives at the federal level and right here for everyone along the way to do what? Create more competition with local production. And that means lower prices. Because if we don't do this, the fuel will go where the market wants it, where it will pay the money. And that means we'll miss out on the benefit of lower prices and greater competition. And that's what we need most of all.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for that very informative panel. And I really appreciate you being here. And I know you'll be available on Friday as well if there's any questions, some of you. Correct? Okay. Thank you. I want to bring up Senator Holmquist from Washington, who's been very patient. And after that, we're going to have a couple of farmers from Klamath County that is here today. So, Senator? Did I lose the senator? Okay. She's in the back.
I fully support her.
Thank you so much for your patience.
Yes, but I seem to ask her questions. No, I'm just... I know.
Well, thank you for being here today, and welcome to Oregon.
Well, thank you so much for the invite. I've actually had the opportunity, and for the record, my name is Janelle Holmquist, state senator from the 13th Legislative District in Washington State. And 13th doesn't mean anything probably to anyone here, so that's central Washington. We start right at the ridge of Snoqualmie Pass, and then we shoot up the I-90 corridor, and we encompass all of Kittitas County, most of Grant County, and a little bit of Yakima County. Now, I passed around something because first thing I want to say on the record is I'm not here to tell you what's best for Oregon. What I would love to do is just give you my experience on what we've done in Washington State, and then it is up to you guys as the policymakers to do what's best for Oregon. And so at the end of this, I just like to make sure that I hope that I will be a resource for you as you continue to go through these discussions. And also on the way here, I spoke with the governor's office, and she sends a friendly hello and hopes that we can work more together in regards to helping to spur on the renewable fuel industry. Just quickly, a little bit of background I think it's important to note is that my district, for example, is it's based on agriculture. And, of course, Washington State's economy is based on agriculture. And I grew up on a farm. We raised cattle, horses, and hay, so that's in my blood and in my background. And I have served 3 terms in the House, and this is my first term in the Senate. And this idea about a renewable fuel standard wasn't an idea that I thought of. It wasn't an idea that Governor Gregoire thought of. This was an idea that was brought to me years ago by a group of farmers. And there were Farm Bureau members right in the heart of my district that came to me as a representative at that time and said, you know, Representative Holmquist, Washington State has all the necessary tools in its toolbox to be very successful in the renewable fuel industry. But I think we need a little help. And what they needed was market access. And that's what I really think a renewable fuel standard is about. And I can tell you, I'm a conservative Republican, so when you say the ugly M word, mandate, yes, it makes me leery. And I look at every mandate, and I try to judge it on its merits. And what, you know, its positive as well as its negative potential impacts. And, oh, by the way, Representative Jensen, I had to say hello because I also had the opportunity, I'll interject here really quick, Senator Walker invited me to come speak to her committee in Pendleton. And if I recall right there, you were at that meeting, Representative Jensen. Yes. Back on track here, but we're talking about the lovely, the M word, the mandate word, and renewable fuel standard. What I found in Washington State is that we had incentives on the books for years, and I've got to thank folks on both sides of the aisle that worked to get those incentives in place, but it wasn't doing it. And when I first drafted my renewable fuel standard measure a few years ago, I can tell you that it got a lot of attention, but not enough attention until the fuel prices spiked 2 summers ago, and then all of a sudden it was the governor, Democrats as well as Republicans, that started looking at my bill going, you know, I think you got something here. And, of course, it was modeled after the federal legislation, their renewable fuel standard. But when I had the first couple years of hearings, I had many, many private venture capitalists that came to those hearings, and they said, you know what, we would love to make Washington our home. But we need the assurance that we could have market access to the consumers, that if we actually put up shop, produce the fuel, that we could actually get that fuel into the consumers' gas tanks. And same thing with the farmers. The farmers who brought me this idea, they said, you know what, we would need market assurance and market access for those crops. And for Washington State, we were not growing very much biodiesel feedstock whatsoever. So we, in the renewable fuel standard adoption, we actually created a new commodity market there, which, of course, has positive impacts across the board in regards to commodities and agriculture. And what I handed out to you really quickly, and I think the highlights section, by the way, many of my questions were answered, and I was trying to take notes back there, so I'm going to try not to duplicate anyone else's comments. But this is just since our renewable fuel standard was adopted, and we passed it through the legislature last year. I was the prime sponsor on the House version, and we had a Senate version, and one of those rare experiences where we had Democrats and Republicans and farmers and environmentalists all together asking for the same thing, and I think that's very unique, and it says something too, and it speaks to the issue. The next few pages you have there, just, and I won't run through everything, but it just has a quick run through of what our renewable fuel standards looks like, and I might point out some things that we have that you may want to consider. I think you have some more strengths in some of your incentives than we do in our incentives, so I think we can learn something from each other. On that.
Not to steal all your business.
Oh, no. Hey, bring it on. Well, and I think the thing there is this isn't about Washington versus Oregon or anything like that. This is, and you've heard about all the positive impacts. This is about, you know, taking hold a little bit of our own destiny back right now, being dependent on foreign, and I'd like to say domestic, oil, petroleum products, revitalizing our agricultural communities, creating jobs, and, of course, cleaner air is the big bonus there. But all of those plants that you see listed there are just since we adopted our renewable fuel standard. Governor Gregoire actually came to my home of Moses Lake, Washington, and she signed the bill. And now you can see there that we have two, and one of them you just heard from, Pacific Ethanol, is looking at both Washington and Oregon, which I think is great, but two potential ethanol plants moving into Moses Lake. And I will note that this last one, Liquefaction Corporation, is affiliated with Willie Nelson. So, yes, Willie Nelson is coming to Moses Lake, Washington. Just kind of a fun little thing to note there. But when you look at, and the way we did it, and just a little background of what, the way Washington State did it, and again, I won't tell you what's best for you, but we kind of had a three-legged stool approach. We had incentives is one leg, which was very important. We had some state dollars that was available through low-interest loans and grants to help get some of the infrastructure up and running. And then the third leg was the renewable fuel standard. And so that was those three legs of the stool that allowed us to spur on. And since the adoption with all three legs, and this is just some numbers that we've been, I think they're growing, is that I think it's, at this point, it's created well over 500 jobs. I think it's getting much closer to 1,000 jobs. And it should be bringing close to $1 billion of private venture capital into our state. Now, in my home of Moses Lake, you'll notice Warden is a little town right next to Moses Lake, but that's a biodiesel plant that will be opening its doors this year. And they're already trying to sign contracts with farmers. And they're also looking to Oregon farmers. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for farmers across just, you know, the Pacific Northwest on that. Okay, I don't want to repeat things, so let me grab a couple more thoughts here. I guess bottom line in regards to what we were able to do in Washington State is we look back now, and I think for our investment, it has had, you know, over 12 times the payoff. So when you're looking at this and on how it's going to pay off and whether it's a worthy investment for your state, look at it that way. And the way we also looked at it is right now you have the federal government leading this. They had a renewable fuel standard. It started fairly small. At the time I was doing my bill, it was a 4 billion gallon renewable fuel standard that basically that tells the oil companies you must utilize 4 billion gallons of renewable fuels. Of course, now it's up to 7.5. And then we heard from President Bush last night that he would like by 2017 to be 35 billion gallons of alternative fuels. And he feels, with all the information in front of him, that that would allow us to cut foreign imports from the Middle East by three quarters. So that is just wonderful. And so the way we saw it as Washington State is, in light of the federal renewable fuel standard, there's a window of opportunity, and I think there's a window of opportunity for Oregon to be a leader in this as well, is that you know the minimum market is set, partly because of the federal mandate. What you have an opportunity to, as a state, is to also, through your own renewable fuel standard adoption, to have access to part of that market, to have the infrastructure make, come home to Oregon, basically, and to create jobs, as well as to give your consumers an option. Because I think a lot of this isn't just market access for the farmers, it's just not market access for the producers of the fuel, but market access for the consumers. So consumers have an option and a choice about what kind of fuel they put in their tanks. And I think it is, and it was kind of hit on the previous comments, that it's kind of patriotic. It could be patriotic. Consumers can choose Oregon-grown and Oregon-produced biodiesel, and it is patriotic. They feel like they're doing something that's making a difference, and I think they are doing something that's making a difference. Representation is that every gallon of renewable fuel produced and consumed in Oregon State could represent one less gallon of refined petroleum product from a foreign or domestic source. I've heard some concerns, and I know you will hear some concerns, and boy, did we have fun on our House floor debating concerns, rumors, fear about something new. And I'll go ahead and put out there the concerns that you hear out there in regards to quality standards, some of the things that Minnesota had to learn the hard way. All of my research, and I'm one that likes data, facts, science. That's what I like to base my decisions on. And all of my research says is that the problems were never that they didn't have standards. It wasn't that they didn't have high enough standards. The issue is that some of that fuel got out to the consumer's tanks that did not meet the standards. And so, but based on ASTM standards, you should have yourself covered in this. I know Washington State, we feel very comfortable with the ASTM standards. And some manufacturers are actually going to go above and beyond, looking at the petroleum industry as a model, and they're going to have things similar to like a certificate of analysis where not one drop would get past the refinery level unless it meets those standards. So those types of fears, just don't let them stop you and hold you back. I just try to learn as much, and I have a lot of information, so please, again, use me as a resource and keep moving forward, because no matter what form your renewable fuel standard looks like, or your bill, whatever you want to call this that you guys are having a hearing on today, it's still a step in the right direction. So I definitely want to encourage you in that. And just a couple more thoughts here. You already answered my question about your state's fleet. We had a portion of that actually in our bill, and so I commend you on that, as well as Portland, of course, their leadership in this. I think there's another a bonus with you doing a state renewable fuel standard is that you are going to provide some continuity across your state, as well as coming into Washington, perhaps, is that consumers will have a choice as they go fill up their fuel tanks as they travel through the Pacific Northwest, and I find that great. One thing we do have in our bill that you might consider, especially when we're talking about consumer choice, is that we are in your Department of Ag, looks like they have the rulemaking authority to do this, perhaps in your proposed legislation, but we're actually going to label our gas tanks, so consumers know what the blend is. So if they want to know what they're putting in their gas tanks, they can know it. You could even, if you wanted to, I don't know how you'd manage this, we're trying to get a handle on this as well, but some folks would like to know if it's Washington grown in our state, and maybe your folks would want to know whether it is Oregon grown, Oregon produced. And one other, maybe two other quick things. First off, Representative Burley, yes, you asked a question about gelling. Yes, you asked a question about gelling points, and one thing I learned is that it's not as simple as a 2% or 5% isn't going to gel, which is truthful. It really matters what sort of feedstock you're going to use. For example, canola, and specifically different kinds of canola, winter canola, they all have different gelling points. Canola, you can go well below zero, and it's not going to gel. So even if someone running on B100 in my neck of the woods, where we have snow on the ground right now, they're doing just fine. But it matters, and there's different gel points for soy versus palm versus canola. So look at that, too. It really matters what the feedstock is. And then one other thing I will definitely note, and something I'm working with my colleagues in Washington State, is that Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington farmers need greater access to water. And as we transition from petroleum-based fuel to agricultural-based fuel, we need to realize that water is our oil. The more water farmers have access to, the more they can grow, and the more petroleum-based lessening our dependence on petroleum-based fuel we can move towards. So, and that's something I definitely heard at Senator Walker's hearing, because right after she had the renewable fuel section, she had a section on water, and I'm hearing the same message from our folks in Eastern Washington that I heard there in Eastern Oregon. So remember, there's a definite tie there between water policy and setting good water policy to support a renewable fuel industry. And at that point, I think I will just go ahead and close by thanking the Madam Chair, Representative Dingfelder, as well as, the other chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Oh, yes. Representative Barnhart, please forgive me, as well as the vice-ranking members, Representative Burley and Representative Butler, for the invitation. And I'm just thrilled. I think it's very seldom that there's an issue. I know for me in the legislature that you know will have positive benefits for future generations. And that this is one of those issues that you can actually just get your hands and your arms around, and you know it's going to make a difference down the road, not only for your state, but for our nation. And I look forward to hopefully having Oregon join in with the state renewable fuel standard. I think we're setting a good example. And it's really, again, it's about an opportunity. It's going to happen in the United States. But do you want the business here? Do you want the jobs here? Do you want to help revitalize and diversify your agriculture here in Oregon? And of course, cleaner air. It's just such a win-win. And again, thank you for this opportunity. And if you have any questions, please feel free.
Thank you so much, Senator. We really appreciate you sharing your Washington experience. And I'd like to know if you want to come back when we have the House on the bill and carry it on the floor, because I think you do. I think you do a fabulous job. Maybe we can work some interstate agreement out there. But before I take any questions, I would like to call up Katie Fast from the Oregon Farm Bureau. Can you stay up here to answer? Because we're going to have questions all at the same time. Tracy Liskey with Liskey Farms and Richard Walsh from Klamath County Agricultural Area, because I'm concerned we're going to run out of time, and these folks came all the way from Klamath, so I just want to make sure that we get to hear your testimony, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions, and then I don't know if I want to make sure that we will also have the senator's contact information, so if there's follow-up questions that we have, we can email or call you about those. I think it would be really helpful. And we were almost, I just want to say, if the package was passed last time, then we would be up in Washington testifying. Or we would have been up in Washington testifying. So, Kate, if you can be brief, and I know that you have some folks here, and I want to make sure we got to hear their testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and Chair Barnhart. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Katie Fast, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon agriculture thrives through our diversity of the crops that we grow, and renewable energy provides another segment of diversity for Oregon agriculture. And as Oregon Farm Bureau is a general agriculture organization and represents farmers from the broad aspect of the industry, it's a challenge for us to find a balanced position when it comes to renewable energy, because while some segments of the industry will benefit, other segments or the entire industry will be impacted by the policy decisions that you make regarding any of the renewable bills you'll see. Nationally, you'll hear some comments in regards to this dealing with the price of corn, and farmers are benefiting here in Oregon and across the nation with the high prices of corn and other grains and seed stocks that we're receiving due to the ethanol boom. However, the livestock industry is facing challenges as they are trying to supply feedstocks through a corn-based processing. Distiller grains that you've heard about today from the ethanol industry cannot replace all of the rations needed for the dairy and beef industries. They still need unprocessed corn as part of their feedstocks. So that's a challenge that the livestock industry is facing due to renewable fuels. Also, I think on another day you'll hear more from the Department of Agriculture dealing with canola and the concerns coming from segments of the agriculture industry, with canola being grown in the Willamette Valley and other areas of the state, and its potential impacts on our vegetable seed industry and fresh vegetable industry as well. ODA has protections put in place that limit production of canola here in the Willamette Valley and other parts of the state. We are in support of those rules. We are also in support of continued research to look at canola's impact on other segments of agriculture and also alternative biofuel crops for these areas of the state. Taking all these issues into perspective, we are supportive of 2210 and believe it brings opportunities to Oregon that are healthy for the entire agriculture community. It brings rotation crops and diversity to our operations and economic development to the rural areas. There are very many important pieces to 2210. However, we also see some continued opportunities for improvement. And I want to highlight maybe just a few of those and then turn off to people who are actually in the industry. The first is the tax credit for producers of biofuels feedstocks. The $1 per million BTU that is in the bill is not adequate for Oregon producers. It only equates what I've been told from people who understand what 1 million BTU is. It only equates to about $8 per acre of biofuels. And in current crop prices, when we're looking at wheat ground as a potential to grow canola on, that is not an adequate subsidy or trade-off that the farmer is going to make management decisions and change their operation on. And so we're happy to work with the committee and others on finding the adequate amount for that place. And those discussions already happened with Department of Energy and Department of Agriculture. The next piece I'd like to touch on is the renewable fuel standard. We only support a renewable fuel standard that is based on Oregon agricultural products, or at least on the Northwest. And that is seen in the biodiesel fuel standard, but not in the ethanol fuel standard. The ethanol fuel standard you heard will be met and kicked in by the production coming from two ethanol facilities whose business models are based mainly on Midwest corn. Pacific Ethanol will be contracting acres here in Oregon and potentially in Washington, but the majority of those are Midwest production, not Oregon production, and we don't see the tie of helping Oregon agriculture through a renewable fuel standard based on that model. However, Oregon does have potential for cellulosic ethanol down the road, and we can provide the feedstocks through straw and other agricultural byproducts, timber thinnings, and growing crops for that industry, such as switchgrass and others. Then moving on to the land use clarifications that are in the bill, we are in support of that section as well. However, it does not sufficiently address how Oregon's operations are going to be utilizing fuel. We're happy to work with the committee. We're actually have a committee, a Farm Bureau committee, looking at that segment of the bill and making suggestions currently in conjunction with this committee meeting today. So we'll be bringing some amendments forward in the next day. Okay. And with that, I'd just like to turn it off with Tracy for the real-life perspective of on the ground.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We apologize for running over. We are about to be kicked out of this room, so I will ask you to be brief, and I would like to say that if you can hang out, and my members might have some questions for you, but I really do appreciate you being here today and coming all the way from Klamath.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tracy Liske. I'm a farmer in Klamath Falls, also First Vice President of Oregon Farm Bureau. And the lady to my left over here said we do know what water and agriculture do have in common in the climate. So it does come true. One of the things, you know, I have no prepared speech, but one of the major things in this bill that I'm looking from is agriculture and from Farm Bureau and just from my area is making sure local agriculture has an industry. Klamath Basin, again, poor water, poor situations, not good growing. It's a rotation crop. Canola works very well for us, or looks like it will. But with the ethanol plants coming in and pulling the corn prices out of the Midwest, it's taken our food stock up to a price that doesn't make canola worth growing. So it becomes, you know, a catch-22 on that situation. So we need the incentives to make sure that the local producers grow the food. And, you know, you're talking about rural development, and if we're bringing this oil in out of the Northwest, it doesn't help Eastern Oregon. And Eastern Oregon needs the help. And so we've got to make sure that the products that we use are Oregon-grown, you know, Northwest definitely, but more, if we can get more incentives for Oregon-grown, let's get more incentives for Oregon-grown, so we can help our rural Oregon. It's been two states for too long, and we need to bring them together. We need to help agriculture in those areas for a long time. And with this corn price, one thing that Eastern Oregon does have is beef cattle. And that price is going down because the corn price is going up. So it's a situation that we really need to emphasize on incentives for the people to grow it. And also big incentives for the smaller production plants. Because one thing about canola, for a million gallon plant, you're talking about 12,000 acres of canola. And on a 4-year rotation, that's a lot of acres. And so you're going to have smaller plants in different areas in Eastern Oregon to make it work. And one of the major problems with that is you get your gas companies and your distributors, and they don't want to go get 1,000 gallons here and 1,000 gallons there. So they want to haul 30,000 gallons at a whack. And so, you know, you've got to make incentives so they have to buy it, or they get some credit for going and getting it, or something in that order, so it makes it work, especially if you're going to mandate standards on the people of Oregon. You need it to go to Oregon so it works. And we're not against, you know, I don't really like mandates. Representative Smith, I can see where he's coming from on almost all these questions, and I agree with him in a lot of the ways. But as long as it's working, so we make sure that the agriculture in Oregon is one of the beneficiaries of that, and the people of Oregon, if they're going to pay for it, might as well have their state benefit from it. And so that's where the incentives in that area that I want to go through. And, you know, and one of the statements, this, you know, you give standards give a choice, and I don't know how that really happens. Standards don't give you a choice, but that's kind of a different situation. But we need to make sure the incentives are out there and kept, not only for the producers, for the biofuel plants, for the small biofuel plants that the farmers can own and run and help with, but also for the distributors to make sure they utilize that and can utilize it economically so they can compete at the same time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lissy. Mr. Walsh, do you want to add a few comments?
Yes, thank you for having me here today, you folks. And I've got just, Tracy's put mostly what I had, but the only thing
and
I had...
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Okay. Rick Walsh from Klamath Falls, and I'm a local grower in Klamath Falls, and then we also have a small million-gallon plant we're putting in for biodiesel. And our feedstock is what we're planning on is canola, and a lot of it's on the coal flow situation for the Klamath Falls area. But for a rural development, this plan will give us about 12 jobs for this area, and just for the rural people there, that's going to be a help and benefit. And we're looking for the canola, but we need the help with getting it grown. You've got farmers out there that's 2, 3, 5 generations, and they've grown this wheat and this barley for year after year after year, and they know how to grow it. And the bankers know they know how to grow it, and the dollars are there. And so we're asking them, well, here's a brand new crop we're going to have you grow. And they're saying, and the banker's saying, well, look at the price of this barley. Barley was $70 a couple years ago. Now it's $120. Why do you want to change when you can make up some of your debt? And wheat prices have gone up the same on that, and that's where they're going to stay. And we need this subsidy from the grower to produce the biodiesel. The biodiesel is easy to produce, but the feedstock is where the trouble lies to get it. We need the grower to grow it to supply the plant. And the plant can produce the diesel or the biodiesel to supply the Oregonians.
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. I was going to see if there were one or two quick questions for our panelists, especially I want to thank the senator for making the trek all the way here from Olympia. Does anyone have a quick question?
I think they're brilliant.
Representative Wentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question for the panel, but if somebody could draw me a map of areas in Oregon that are prohibited from growing canola, I would like to have that map.
Yeah, and I apologize because Katie Koba is actually here with Brent Searle. They were going to talk about that today, but I'd ask them to come back on Friday and talk about that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the patience of the committee, and there will be a little more time on Friday. We have a lot of people that do and want to come talk about this bill, and I appreciate all the excellent questions, and thank you to all the panelists. And with that, the public hearing for House Bill 2210 and the House Committee on Energy and Environment is adjourned.
And the House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.